It's easy to understand people who are really benefiting from this in terms of getting their follower counts to explode. But they're only able to make money because there are millions of people who are buying what they're selling. That is something that I think we don't grapple with enough. It's really easy to just write it all off as a grift. But a grift only works if you've got customers. What I've seen is everyday people sharing different conspiratorial ideas with each other. Some of those, like calls against bringing in a central bank digital currency, haven't gained much traction. But what is seen to capture folks is anti-trans stuff, in particular when it comes to fear-mongering around how kids are expressing themselves and what they're learning in school. That energy from the COVID lockdown, it's like a heat-seeking missile. It's looking for where it's going to get its next energy lift.
But how do you rationalize the sky is on fire?
Well, they have a rationale. I mean,
I know.
They say it's a directed energy weapon actually set fire to Maui.
God, you've really done your homework on this. It's amazing you held your brain together.
Actually, I learn things in interviews. Like somebody said to me, I was talking to somebody who spends actually more time in these worlds than I do. And apparently there's a conspiracy that the sun isn't real.
Oh, the earth is flat. I mean, but like, I mean, oh man, I don't.
They're like, don't you think it looks weird? It's like, yeah, it looks weird because of wildfire smoke.
Well, Dr. Tim, everyone's gathered for the Daily Miracle. Here's your microphone.
Ever since the sun took LSD, it's been a fundamentally better sun. More pink and green and electric blue. Let's hope it comes up again today. Here it comes.
He's done it again. It's coming up. It's coming up.
Oh, it's painfully. Is anybody gracing for an ass?
All right, group. It's time to meditate on the pure white light of stupidity. Let's hear it for our guru. One, two, three.
G-U-R-U.
I'm not at all happy with the flashcard section. Now come on, you freaks. Say the word and you'll be free. Say the word and be like me. Say the word I'm thinking of. Have you heard? The word is love.
Love.
Anti-trans hysteria is definitely a big area that this movement is turning towards. And, more broadly, anti-LGBTQ. It's expanding very quickly. And also the idea that there's going to be a climate lockdown, that any sort of benign municipal attempt to put in a bike lane or restrict parking is actually a plot to lock you into your house forever. And that's why you see city councils being stormed. There's a lot of crossover between the two, to be clear. In Europe, a lot of this energy is going into anti-immigrant sentiment and border control, really, fascism. I was in Ireland on my book tour, and they had just had this protest outside their parliament, which is called the Dáil. And they were trying to make sense of that protest. It was anti-immigrant, anti-trans, and anti-climate action and anti-vaccine. And they were like, it's completely incoherent. But I think that there is something that is coherent about it. And it has to do with the figure of the child, and the site of the family as a site of control. And the nation as a set of controls. A lot of it is about selling this illusion that in these really frightening times you can control your body and your kid, and own your nation. The figure of the child is absolutely central to it, and the child as a kind of a double of the parent. Which is why I think they are so able to mobilize around anti-trans bigotry.
As a family, it's going into turnaround, and Astrid wants custody of the child.
Astrid wants Solly?
No, George. Solly's out of Margot, my second wife.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Astrid wants custody of my inner child, the child within.
That's new.
Yeah.
It really calls on us, I think, to push back on the whole narrative that parents have a right to own their children, that their children are their double, their little mini-me. Children have autonomy, they have a right to their own identity, they have a right to privacy, they have rights. Whether that is the name they're called at school or the book they want to read at the library. It's really important that we have a robust discourse around children's autonomy, which obviously is not limitless. Kids do need controls around them. But they're not our property.
What about the custody situation?
She wants every other weekend with your inner child.
Oh, she does, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, George, I talked to the child within me.
Really?
Yeah, and he's getting his own lawyer.
Legalorum Trentio, Arbis Pecularum Bandini.
Huh?
Plant a lawyer, grow a money tree.
The other part of it that's occurred to me is a sort of purity ideal or purity culture, which does kind of ideologically knit together a lot of those different factions. Purity and naturalness, yes, appeals to the natural. It's this idea of the vaccine as a kind of intrusion, of poisoning, and then it moves to the poisoning of kids' minds and bodies. And I think that that's where the door is open also to racial purity discourse and nationalist discourse. As people in Canada have been trying to make sense of what was underpinning the trucker convoy or the recent 1 million March 4th children, they'll often say the rhetoric and strategies have been imported from the United States, rather than being homegrown. Does that align with what you saw as you were researching? Or do people who live in Canada need to have a reckoning about the homegrown drivers of these movements? There are certain code words that are a little bit more American, like maybe parents' rights is a little bit more of a U.S. framing, but I think Canadians generally are way too quick to claim that this is a particularly American phenomenon. That's why, for example, it's so important to know about the history of environmentalism in BC, and the fact that it has long had elements that were entwined with xenophobia and fascistic thought. So no, it's not just that we've been importing. But one thing I will say is that, for example, Joe Rogan has the top podcast in the UK. Increasingly, I feel like we're living on archipelagos of podcasts. Whatever idea we have in our heads of what it means to be Canadian, or what it means to be American or Irish, it's becoming less important than our respective media diets and the kind of culture that we're absorbing that way. So I think the roots are very real here in our settler colonial nation. But I also think that there's ways in which the massive power of certain communicators are knitting together an international language and project. It's been very clear since Steve Bannon left the White House that he's about building a nationalist international, and he takes it very seriously. Those are some of the moments where I was the most taken aback listening to his podcast. It's more international than a lot of leftist media. He's really paying attention to how it's going with Marine Le Pen in France, and how it's going with Giorgia Meloni in Italy, and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil. And I'm not saying that we don't pay attention to it, but there is always a risk of parochialism on the North American left, and he's got an international project. It's a nationalist international project, and they're uniting in xenophobia. They're trading tactics, they're trading language, they're seeing what works. Bolsonaro ran putting out these memes that cast his opponent, Fernando Haddad, who had been education minister under the PT government, as a groomer and a pedophile, and he won. So I think I would just say both things are true. We shouldn't be smug. And there really is a trading of tactics across borders.
Would you like to settle this war right now?
Yeah,
I mean, okay. Let's look, between two idiots, look, you're an idiot and I'm an idiot,
okay,
we both know
but I'm,
that.
I'm the head idiot of my country.
Okay, you can be the head idiot of your country if I can be the head idiot of my country.
I'll grant you
what
that.
What about all those little countries
look
in between?
Those two dumb guys.
Okay, what did you say?
Well, what about all these little countries in
those
between?
Those little countries, look at them, they're full of idiots.
Those guys
they're full of idiots just like us.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Hey, you here. Little idiots, any of you idiots over there want to come over here with us idiots and solve this cause war?
We're the heads of the pin trust over here.
We're not smart enough to understand about that kind of stuff.
We're the dummies.
Look, I'm the dumbest guy in my country.
That's true.
And you're the dumbest guy in your country.
I'll come and live in your country.
Then
I won't have to be the dumbest guy anymore.
I'll go over to your country, too. It'll be great. Those Moscow girls really knock me out.
Golly.
They leave the West behind.
A colleague of mine, when we were chatting about this interview, said they felt like everything you've written about in your books just keeps getting worse. In a strange way, your trip into the mirror world, even though it's at first discouraging, seems to bolster your spirits by the end. Could you talk a bit about that? Are you feeling more optimistic about where we're at with regards to conspiracy culture and the climate? What I feel is more oriented. I was truly confused by the way in which political signals were getting scrambled in periods in the pandemic, and kind of felt a bit speechless. And I think I wrote myself into a position of greater orientation, which is what one always does with writing. It starts very chaotic and confused, and we slowly order our thoughts and come out of it feeling more lucid. The process of writing and editing and refining did that for me. But in terms of feeling hopeful, I don't think that's anything that I can do on my own. As I say at the end of the book, I think that's collective work. And so the extent to which I feel a little bit buoyed depends on the news of the day. When the auto workers are on strike and the screenwriters are on strike and there's all kinds of solidarity breaking out and it feels like there might be a pulse on the left again, that gives me great optimism, especially because I think it's addressing real issues. And it makes it a lot harder for important issues to be co-opted and mixed and matched with this really nefarious, far-right agenda. But today, I don't feel great. I'm absolutely horrified by the war crimes being committed in Gaza. I think we are in for a very long and brutal process of ethnic cleansing. And I think there needs to be very sharp moral clarity and values governing our responses to all of it. I feel absolutely heartbroken and devastated by what's happening in Gaza and Israel. Part of the reason why I've been outspoken about the need to mourn all deaths and recognize that targeting of civilians is a crime, even as we recognize that the responsibilities are obviously different between an occupied people living in an open-air prison and the occupiers, with all of the weapons that are possible to design and buy, is that I think it's incredibly important that our responses be governed by an unwavering commitment to human rights law. We have to oppose war crimes in every situation. And just be guided by a cherishing of human life. As I say in the book, what binds the yoga teacher in British Columbia who is saying maybe they should die about immunocompromised people and a great replacement gunman are these ideas about purity and a rationalizing of huge, huge losses of human life. It sounds simplistic and corny to say we have to be the people who cherish life, but that's actually a very radical position in a world that is allowing migrants to drown in the Mediterranean and swim into saws in the Rio Grande, and telling people to go back to work and not wear a mask, despite their vulnerabilities. This is a brutal culture. It's a necropolitics at work. And I don't know how you fight necropolitics without standing for the value of human life.
You say something at the end of Doppelganger, I'll read the whole quote in a sec, but it really comforted me when you say, that's okay. Here's the quote. You say, the known world is crumbling. That's okay. It needed to crash. Now in the rubble, we can make something more reliable, more worthy of our trust, more able to survive the coming shocks. So thank you for making me feel comfortable by saying that's okay, that the world is crumbling. But what do you want that world to look like realistically, Naomi?
I think if there's a guiding principle that I think we need, it is a rejection of the idea that some people can be sacrificed, that some places can be sacrificed.
First, they had to come from little towns with strange names like
Smegma,
Spasmodic,
Frog, and the far-flung Isles of Langerhands.
But who were they?
We were small, angry men with hairy faces and burning feet. We were running away from poverty, intolerance, and the law
and the army.
And we took to them.
And they took to us.
And what do you think they took?
Oil from Canada, gold from Mexico, geese from the neighbor's backyard, boom, boom. Corn from the Indians, tobacco from the Indians, Dakota from the Indians, New Jersey from the Indians, New Hampshire from the Indians, New England from the Indians, New Delhi from the Indians.
Indonesia for the Indonesians!
Yes, Veterans Day.
But we couldn't do it alone.
No, we needed the hope, the faith, the prayers, the fears.
The sweat, the pain, the boils, the tears.
The broken bones.
The broken homes.
The total degradation of...
Who?
You.
If we look at the number of people who are being forced out of their homelands right now because of wars, because of climate disasters, the issue is not just the coming weather disruptions that we need to think about. We need to think about what kind of people we want to be as we face these shocks. So when I think about what that stability is, it is a core belief that we are equal to one another. And just because somebody lives in another country, just because somebody doesn't look like us, does not mean that we can come up with some sort of rationale that says, well, we can just watch them drown, or we can just let them disappear. That's the monster at the gate that I worry most about. And it isn't just out there, it's inside. And that's the thing about doppelgangers. You think you're looking at them, but they're really holding up a mirror.
Here we are.
Oh my goodness.
What's happening? Am I seeing double? There's two of everybody except me.
Pandemonium was breaking out all around me.
Wait a minute.
Who are you? I was here first. You imposter. Take that.
That's terrible.
You keep away from him, you young hussy.
Who are you calling a hussy, you old bag?
Well, how dare you talk to me like
that? I can talk to me any way I like.
What nerve? I'm not you. You're me 20 years ago.
What? You have a lot of nerve saying I'm going to look like that in 20 years?
Oh, yeah?
There ain't room enough in this dress for both of us. Get your knife.
Well, this is a bit of fun, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is, Dad. Glad to have someone my own age to talk to after all these years.
Why don't we sing something?
Well, I've forgotten the key.
Oh, that's all right. I've got a lid out in the car.
David?
Half-caste woman, living a life apart. Where did your story begin?
Stop it! Stop singing, you fools! Can't you see someone has been crushed here under this car? Oh, my God, it's me! I don't look at all well. I'm dead! I've been killed! Oh, this hasn't happened to me since M!
I did a quick 20-20 on the whole scene.
I thought that I was the only one going insane. But now we are all in this together.
I don't understand.
I knew what I had to do.
I didn't
like it, but that never stopped me before. All right, everybody! Take off your